This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
Hello and welcome again to the Locker Room on Indie Live Radio. We'll be here every week looking at the world of sport, not only in Scotland, but the UK and maybe the world sometimes as well. So I'm joined by Matthew again. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, Michael. How's things?
Not bad. How's it going over in Ireland?
It's not too bad. Same old, yeah, nothing changes.
So last week was our first episode of speaking about sport. So it's going to be a weekly show now. So we're going to speak about all things. I was going to say all things balls, but that sounds a bit rude. So everything to do
why
with
not?
Sport. Yeah, exactly. So we've got a busy show this week and lots to come up, but going to start with a bit of sad news this week, Matthew, about the snooker legend Willie Thorne. He died at the age of 66.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really know him as a player as such. I mean, when he was a player, I think it was in the 1980s, and he managed to reach two World Championship quarterfinals during his career. So he was well known as a player, but unfortunately, it was just before my time. But he was known as a commentator, and I think that was when I knew him, when he was a commentator for the BBC, and I think he was also a commentator with ITV and Sky, and he was well known as such and well loved as a commentator on snooker. So he knew his stuff, and it was sad when he was diagnosed with leukemia in March. And it was sad to see that, and I think he was only recently taken to hospital in Spain with dangerously low blood pressure. So it was sad to see he was in hospital, obviously, with low blood pressure and leukemia, but sadly he did pass away this week, so it'll be a loss to the game of snooker.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit like you. I didn't remember him playing snooker, but all I can remember him was commentating on the World Championship at Sheffield. He's been on BBC, and I used to watch a programme on a Saturday night. It was called, for the life of me, I can't remember, but it was presented by John Virgo, and it was like celebrities, and when they port the balls, whoever the guests are, they get points or whatever.
Well, yeah, I remember that now. Do you know, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. I remember that was actually a really big thing, was it not?
It was, yeah. It was a big thing on a Saturday night. You know, Mafia, I can really go back to speak about the old days, but don't ask me what I had for my dinner last night, you know?
don't talk to me about my dinner. When I was watching the football last night, I had a cold pie and a Bovril just to bring back the whole football experience. So that was my dinner last night. It was takes me back to the SPL completely with the cold pie. It was roasting hot on the outside, but freezing in the middle. Yeah. Typical.
I mean, no matter when people die, it's always a sad time, but especially a household name like Willie Thorne, you know.
And it's funny you mentioned that TV show, because I didn't remember the TV show, but I remember him. Wasn't he one of the players that sung with Chaz and Dave when they had a song about snooker? I think it was called Snooker Loopy or something like that.
It was in the 80s.
And the only reason I remember that is Chaz and Dave. I found them a unique pairing. But I think it was him and a few other snooker players were in that song, and it did quite well in the UK charts, I don't think it got to number one, but it was quite high up.
So, yeah, so that was what they formed. It died this week at the age of 66. So we're going to move on now to speak about another kind of big issue in not even Scotland or the UK, but the world at the moment, Matthew, about Black Lives Matters. And obviously, you know, Black Lives, you know, matters to everybody in different walks of society, but also in sport as well. It was good to see, Matthew, that obviously we're going to speak about the Premiership on the way back, but in a wee minute. But it was good to see that before the beginning of each game this weekend, and they were, every player was kind of like kneeling down for a couple of seconds. So I thought that was a big statement to put out there.
Definitely, because those games were shown all around the world, not just in England or in the UK. They were shown everywhere. So I think it showed a bit of solidarity between football players and Black Lives Matter, which is obviously a lot bigger than just sport itself. But obviously, because it's such a wide topic, it infringes in every part of life in regards to black and minority rights and every part of the world, really. So it was good to see Black Lives Matters getting a mention from the players, from the clubs, and also I think before the games, Sky Sports spent a lot of time talking to their pundits about the campaign as such, and yeah, Aston Villa for it. I think Aston Villa's football player Ian Taylor was on there. He was a very big advocate for Black Lives Matters, and he was speaking about it before the game at Villa Park yesterday, so it was good to see that.
And I didn't notice until halfway through the game that all the teams had Black Lives Matters on the back of the scraps as well. So that was good to see.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't notice it either until a player came up, I think it was for Arsenal, that I didn't know who it was. And I went to look at their shirts and I thought, Matters, that's a strange last name. And then I realised what it was. So I think it was good of the clubs to have done that. And it raises awareness for the cause, which, because it seemed to be an American issue, I think some people in Britain don't seem to see the relevance of it. But it's important for everybody in the UK to take this on board, because even though maybe police officers aren't maybe murdering black people as they are in the States, minorities and black people in the UK still have poorer life chances than the white people in the UK. So it's an important issue to stress, really.
I don't know about you, but my kind of take on it is why do things have to happen like this before things get spoke about, if you know what I mean? Because this should have been done years ago or kind of like raised awareness and stuff. But I suppose it's just important it's happening now. But what I'm saying is it should have been the racism and all that in sport or any type of walks of life should have happened years ago.
Definitely, because, I mean, to bring this back to Scottish football a little bit, I mean, Kevin Harper, the ex-Albion Rovers manager, he was the first black player or black manager in Scotland for 15 years since John Barnes was appointed at Celtic. So we've only really had, I think there's three now, black managers who have managed in Scottish football as a whole, and that is a disgraceful situation to be in, considering the amount of black and minority players who have graced our pitches over the years. Three is atrocious. So yeah. Kevin Harper and other people don't think that they should be given a job just purely on their skin colour alone, but all they wish really is an equal opportunity to be able to apply for jobs and interview for jobs. And I think Kevin Harper was suggesting that he knew that when he applied for certain jobs in Scotland, he might have had a better or at least equal CV to some people who were actually given interviews or appointed to jobs. Mm. And that's pretty sad indictment of Scottish football, really.
And also this week, Kamarok is appointed. Alex Dyer, he's been about Kamarok for a wee while, but when you're saying black managers, well, he could be the next kind of black manager in Scottish football, so that was good to see. And he's a good manager as well, you know?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Kamarok, it was hard for Kamarok because obviously Stevie Clark was there. And he did an amazing job, but then obviously he went on to manage Scotland. And I think Kilmarnock kind of were on a bit of a loss as to how to replace him. And when they did, it wasn't the best of choices, really. And I think Kilmarnock struggled to get over the Steve Clark thing. And I think in December, Alex Dyer was appointed as interim manager. But he did well. He stabilised Kilmarnock last season. I mean, they won 4 and drew 2 of their 15 games. Mm. By all accounts, he seemed quite popular in the dressing room with the managers and other coaches and things. So I think Alex Dyer is a great appointment for Kilmarnock, and it's on a 2-year deal, I'm led to believe. So fingers crossed for him that he's the start of black and minority managers coming into our game.
I want to hear your kind of like take on Matthew about the whole fiasco over John Barnes. He'd done a kind of like interview in the last couple of days, and he was saying that the Celtic fans never took to him because he was black. I don't know about you, but that's a terrible statement to make.
I think John, I mean, he put the cat amongst the pigeons when he came out with that one on social media. Celtic appointed him as manager along with Kenny Dalglish as director of football. And I think at the time there was great hope as to how they would do, really. I think they were seen as the dream ticket at the time. And see, John Barnes, he started off not too bad. He was doing okay. Results were going all right for him. But then I think he had a bit of unluckiness really when Larson broke his leg in Lyon. I think he tried to replace him with Ian Wright and that didn't work out. And then Raphael, pardon my French here, Raphael Shite came in.
Yeah.
Everybody remembers. So he was unlucky on one hand. Number two, his recruitment was atrocious. And then Inverness, Caledonian, Thistle, as he seems to forget really, were a first division club and came to Celtic Park and knocked Celtic out the Scottish Cup 3-1. Mm-hmm. It was an atrocious run of things and he was dismissed due to purely, I think, results rather than race. I think he seems to forget this. And also, there's been other Celtic managers in the past, for example, Lou McCarry, Tony Mowbray, all of these types of managers who were also not given... Well, maybe they see themselves as not being given a fair run at it, but results speak at clubs like Celtic Park. If you're not doing it and you're not challenging for the title, unfortunately, at clubs like Celtic and Rangers, you have to go. Because these are the clubs, really, that the pressure tolls. I mean, maybe if he was at a lower team, the results would have been acceptable to them. But at Celtic and Rangers, whether you're white, black or anything, these results are not going to stand, unfortunately. And John Barnes suffered the consequences, like I said, of bad luck on the pitch, but also poor decisions and transfers, the transfer front.
Now, I know a lot of Celtic fans, and they were, you know, I was speaking to them about it this week, and I was like, well, what's your take on it and stuff like that? And to be honest, they weren't happy. But the point that they were making, and you kind of just made too as well there, was they didn't like John Barnes because he was black. They didn't like John Barnes because of his style of football there. So I think there's a bit of a difference there between racism and, you know, and stuff like that. So
Not definitely.
I just can't believe that he came out with that.
I mean, John Barnes is quite outspoken on the Black Lives Matter things, and a lot of things that he says I agree with 110%. Mm. But I think the Celtic thing was a bit out of order. I think he seems to have a, in that regard, I think he has a limited memory as to what happened at Celtic Park. And as you said, you know, results talk. You know, if Celtic are playing bad but winning and winning trophies, people don't mind as much. But if you're losing games, if you're not playing well, and you're not challenging for things, then at Celtic Park, it's just not acceptable. Well, in 1999 into the 2000 period, Celtic were actually starting to challenge Rangers again. They'd stopped 9 in a row. They were starting to believe that they could win titles again. So at that point, what John Barnes was doing on the pitch, unfortunately, wasn't acceptable to Celtic fans. But race, to me, didn't come into it.
I would give to you Ron the Diver. You know, like, he was white, right? But his style of football wasn't brilliant. He won the league, but the Celtic fans, they still weren't happy with him. But it wasn't because he came from Norway.
The difference as well, I suppose, with him as well, and it shows, is that the first season he came in, he was doing well. The games, the performances were good, and he was winning games and obviously winning the league. But then after that, it became apparent that he couldn't replicate that in the second season. So not only were Celtic not playing well, they were winning league titles, but Rangers were starting to breed down their necks a little bit at that point. And obviously the Scottish Cup semi-final didn't help matters either. So it just goes to show that, you know, when you're winning games and you're playing well, then you're accepted at Celtic, but it's results that talk. So if you then start to fall away and results aren't as good and performances aren't as good, then it's purely your job's on the line, really. But like we were saying, results and not race really determine a job like Celtic.
Do you know, think it's quite sad, me and you speaking about this on a kind of like summer's night, but still speaking about racism?
Oh, in the year 2020... this should be the last thing we are talking about, to be honest. You even have the incidents that happen in Glasgow, for example, and football fans becoming embroiled in violence and singing songs that they shouldn't. I mean, it's 2020 and we're still talking about Black Lives Matter. We're still talking about sectarianism in Scottish football. It's just a joke, to be perfectly honest. These things should not be happening in this day and age. And it's quite sickening that it is.
Do you feel as though sometimes societies kind of move backwards when we're talking about this kind of issue?
It might not have moved back as such. I think it's moved forward in the sense that we're finally talking about it. and it's getting a large platform on media. So, for example, I mean, sectarianism, it took a long time for people to talk about it, and then finally we did start talking about it. And now people are being sounded out and challenged over the sectarianism. Racism was a bit more complicated, and it's taken a bit longer for it to become on stream. I mean, like I was saying to you off air, the NFL, for example, Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback at the NFL club San Francisco 49ers, he took a knee years ago to challenge oppression of black people in regards to police violence. And at the time, a few years ago, he was shot down. He was basically hounded out of San Francisco 49ers. He was hounded out of the NFL. He's not had a club since. So back then, people weren't ready to challenge it within the bigger organisations. But now, even though it's seen as a step back, I suppose, that we're still talking about it, but it's a step forward that now, for example, the NFL are challenging it and actually have admitted that he was right all along and that people should be challenging this sort of racism. Sadly, institutional racism, which is just as bad, if not worse, but now obviously the NFL are accepting that it's okay to protest that. And in that regard, it's a step forward, but it's still sad that we're talking about it.
I think that the difference compared to maybe about 20, maybe more years ago when we spoke about Black Lives Matter, we could speak about it, but I suppose now that because you've got social media and that people get different platforms on, you know, Facebook and Twitter, and they can hold campaigns on there as well and kind of like raise awareness, you know. But I still think it's quite sad in the way that we have to highlight this kind of issue, you know. But in a way it's sad, but in a way it's good to, if you see where I'm coming from here.
Definitely, I think you're right. I think it's sad that we're still talking about it, but it's definitely positive that now, for the first time in regards to black and minority issues, I can actually see the light at the end of the tunnel, in the sense that I would suggest that the majority view is that this is wrong. Mm. And the majority view is we need to do something about it, whether it's in society as a whole or specifically is what we are talking about in football and sport in general. It's seen that some things have to change, and that's a positive thing.
And I think I don't want to get too bogged down in this magic because it's a no. sport show, but it's quite good that Marcus Rashford from Manchester United this week sent a letter to the Prime Minister. But to be honest, it shouldn't take someone outside politics to do that. But I mean, if he sees that, as Marcus Rashford sees that there's an issue, well,
I mean, I agree with you 110%. I think this shows the power of sport in general and getting involved in issues like this. I mean, Marcus Rashford is a Manchester United player, but used his profile as a footballer to highlight poverty issues in England in particular. And to be able to get out there, write a letter, and Boris Johnson then to basically have to do a bit of a humiliating U-turn over free school meals for the poorest families over the summer was a win, really, for the power of sport, and not just sporting issues, but also real life issues. And I think he hopefully will be the first of many players to get involved in this. And the Black Lives Matter does link to this because it does show, it definitely shows the power of sport.
And also that the power of sport. But don't forget that there's millions of Man United fans and all that, and millions of other fans from other clubs will be backing 100%, you know. So it's a good thing that he's kind of like shone a light on it in a kind of way.
Well, definitely. And you've made a good point there, I suppose, as well, is it shows that even though there is power in sport, it doesn't have to be about factionalism, you know. Manchester United fans will inevitably, a lot of them will agree with this, but also all the other clubs in England or fans in England of other clubs will be looking at that and agreeing with them. And I think that is a good thing. And it shows that sport can be uniting as well as dividing. And it's sad, really, that we've talked about the dividing aspect of it, but this is definitely a uniting aspect of it.
We'll just have to wait and see what happens over the next couple of months with Black Lives Matter. And also, when the Scottish football goes back in maybe, say, August time, at the moment, we'll come to Scottish football in a minute, but I'll be interested to see what Scottish football is going to do about it as well, because there you go, the Premiership's done it last night before every game at the weekend as well, so it was good to see. So we'll now we can speak about the Premiership. We've got football back, Matthew. Hey,
I know it was great.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, like I said, last night I sat down with a Bovril, I sat down with a frozen pie. I was recreating going to games again. It was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. Even a 0-0 game to start us off was quite entertaining to watch. So, I mean, the first game was Aston Villa, Sheffield United. And like I said, even a 0-0 game became interesting just to see how it was going to all work out, really, with football and not having any fans in the ground.
And what do you make of the fans? I thought it was quite good.
I thought it was quite good. There was points in the first game where I thought the fans could have geared it up a little bit. There was feelings in the first game that there wasn't a high tempo to it. Now, that may be because it's the first game back, but it may also be because there was no fans in the ground to gear them up. And these two clubs, or Villa in particular, should I say, have struggled really. So it may be because of that, but it may be not having the fans in the ground would be a factor in that. I mean, the game itself had 0-0 written all over it from the start, the first game. The good thing, I think, from the first game, from a Scottish point of view, is John McGinn was back. And looked sharp. I think he had a few chances that the goalkeeper had to save. I think he played nearly an hour or an hour of the game, and he looked like he was getting back to his old self. So from a Scottish point of view, that was brilliant. But obviously the 42nd minute was the thing that really was the talking point of that first game with regards to the goal line technology failing. I mean, I don't know what you thought of that, but I mean, the keeper clearly carried the ball over the line. The watch didn't work. The referee and linesman looked absolutely aghast and didn't know what to do. And therefore, the goal wasn't allowed when it was clearly over the line. So, and according to reports afterwards, the watch may have worked at halftime and told them that it was a goal 3 or 4 or 5 minutes after it, once it was halftime. So, go figure. I think that's the first time that's ever happened in English football.
So, I think, Matthew, I'm going to make a suggestion here, right? So, on behalf of Indy Live Radio, I'm going to, when I'm allowed out the house and stuff like that, right, I'm going to come over to Ireland and pick you up, and we're going to buy the ref a watch for Christmas.
Well, I tell you what, because, I mean, I'll make an admission here and say that I am of the Aston Villa persuasion, to be honest, having lived in Birmingham for a while. I don't want him to have a watch.
Okay.
It works. I'm quite happy with his broken watch.
Oh well, then yeah. But that was a big issue. I think I said to you last week as well that I enjoyed the English football more because I know of the English players a bit more, because when I was watching the German football, the football was a bit boring. There was no atmosphere, and also I didn't really know who was playing for what team. So at least in the Premiership, like, you've got like John McGinn, you've got Tieran Kearney, you've got Andy Robertson at Liverpool, and you can go on and on and on. But it was really good to see the Premiership just back.
Oh, definitely. And the next game, the Man City-Arsenal game, I think showed why it was so good to have English football back. I mean, the first game was a bit of a damp squib in some ways, even though it was a good result for Villa. But the Man City-Arsenal game came into its own. I mean, I don't know, the first 25 minutes of that Man City-Arsenal game, the possession was 50-50. And it was a very Guardiola-esque performance on both sides. Arsenal competed with Man City for possession. When do you ever see that? It was amazing. But then, obviously, the player who I love to watch more than any other, maybe in the Premiership, started to run the show, Kevin De Bruyne.
Oh, yeah, he was good.
From 25 minutes on, that man ran that game. Ran it. Arsenal didn't have an answer for him. And I felt even sorry for people like Kieran Tierney, because while he might have got away with some challenges, I think he was booked in the second half, Tierney was. While he might have been able to compete in the SPL level, Man City, I think, pushed it to another entirely after that. Sterling played well. I think he got the first goal. De Bruyne got a penalty, 2-0. And then Foden finished it off to make it 3-0. Man City, after the 25th minute, were just absolutely a joy to watch.
I might be a bit of a disservice here to Man City, but I have millions of emails coming through from Man City fans now saying, what did you say about that? But I just felt as though it was a typical Arsenal performance. And what I mean by that is, every season people build them up to say, yeah, they'll be a top four club and they'll win the league and blah, blah, blah. But nothing's changed. And okay, the football's been off for, 3 months, 2 months. And when the first game, okay, it was against Man City, but they never really put up a fight, if that makes sense.
I'm the vintage of Arsenal's usual performances being 1-0 to the Arsenal in the 1990s under George Graham. So that's my idea of usual Arsenal. But I mean, I get the point. Arsenal have flattered to deceive for a long time now. And that goes back to even the last days of Wenger being there. The flattered to deceive and not challenged for things. But do you know what? The first 25 minutes of that game at the Etihad, I actually saw glimpses of what they're trying to do there. They're trying to almost compete with the Man City style of things, obviously, because that's obviously going to be their mantra from now on. Is going to be the passing, moving, robotic sort of style. They need to know where they are. They know to pass and move, all that kind of stuff. I think Arsenal showed glimpses in the first 25 minutes of where they're going. They're not obviously at the level of Manchester City yet. It'll take a couple of transfer windows, if not more, for them to get up to that Man City level of things. But yeah, the first 25 minutes, if I was an Arsenal fan, I would be quite happy with what I saw there. Obviously, they fell off after that. Mm. If it's Arsenal or anybody, how do you deal when De Bruyne is on such top form anyway? I mean, if it was Arsenal, it could have been anybody. De Bruyne on that sort of form, it's going to be difficult to beat. But also, when you've got a player like David Luiz at the back, you're always going to make mistakes. And it was his error that cost the first goal that set things on really in train really as to where it was going. They're going to make changes in summer. They're going to make changes in January. They won't be as poor as they were over the last season. But last night, they were showing glimpses of where they were going. I'd be quite happy if I was an Arsenal fan going on.
Mm. But, I mean, the worrying thing is, Liverpool's going to win the league a couple of days over the weekend. But if I was any other fan, I would be worried watching that, saying, well, Man City's no hug a game for 2 months, but they can put on a performance like that, you know?
I mean, Man City, I think if Arsenal were playing maybe any other team apart from Man City or Liverpool, they might have had a chance there. They're not going to compete with Man City. They're not going to compete with Liverpool. They're not going to compete even maybe with Leicester City at the moment, the way Leicester City are playing. However, you know, they've only just appointed their new manager. He has his own ideas. He wants to emulate Guardiola like he was involved in the coaching staff at Manchester City under him. So he knows where he wants to go. But, I mean, he's not really had a transfer window to work in as such. He's still left with the players that were there before. I think they will make changes. Like I said, the first 25 minutes suggested a change of style for Arsenal and to where they wanted to be. They don't have the players to get to that level yet. And they're not. So this season might be ups and downs for them, but I would suggest they will make changes. And with people like David Luiz at the back, they could be playing amazing football, but still have him at the back will always result in errors. Because it was 0-0 until his inevitable error. And then he inevitably got red carded. What can you do with a player like that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think all he missed was to score an own goal, and that was him, you know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, even, okay, it would have been 0-0 if he hadn't made the mistake. Then he decided to do a tackle, which, I mean, even if he'd have let the boy through, was it Sterling, I think? Even if he'd have let him through and he'd have scored, it would have been 2-0 and they had 11 men on the pitch. But instead, he makes a rash challenge. He gets red carded. It's 2-0 and they're down to 10 men. The guy, sadly, has been a liability for Arsenal, but also for all the previous clubs he's been at. So it's not a change.
For me, it was good to see the football gives me back the bottom line. And it's very good that Sky and BT's got to cover the football. But also, the interesting thing for me this week, Matthew, is BBC One is going to cover Premiership games. And I'm sure that's the first time in the history because, you know, before that, they've covered the World Cup, European Championship, the Euros, the FA Cup final, but they've never actually covered a Premiership game, so that's good to see.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think as well, not only are BBC covering Premiership football, which I believe is the first time they've ever had live Premiership action on since the inception of the league in 1992, but also, I think Sky are showing a few free games. BT possibly are showing a few free games. So I think it's good that finally fans are not having to pay big subscriptions to watch some English football games, because it is a national treasure, football, and in particular the English Premier League in England is seen as a national treasure. I think it's fair that all fans have a chance to get to watch these games. Maybe not all of them, obviously, because they need the money to compete at a high level, which is why obviously Sky and BT pay the high prices to the clubs, and the clubs obviously use that to buy the best players. But it's still good to give fans, all fans, an opportunity to watch some games. And I think it's important.
And if you're not a football fan, cover your ears now, because I'm going to say something. I think the football's going to continue to the 2nd of July.
The English Premier League, well, I think that's, they're the games that I think the TV have definitely set in stone, so it'll go on after it.
Continue to cover your ears if you don't like So that was good. Oh, we're waiting for the Premiership to come back in Scotland in August, and that rubbish thing. Let's kind of dive into the women's football for a minute, Matthew. Last week, James Anglos, the boy, I don't know who he is, he's put money into the women's football, and I suppose that's only good for the game in Scotland, because all the women's teams are part-time, is that right?
Yeah, the women's game has been making great progress in the last 5 years. I mean, it's getting attendances that they've never had before. They're getting on the media and the TV and the radio like they never have before. So I think there was a worry that COVID might lose that momentum a little bit in women's football, and that was the big worry. But James Anderson did come in and has donated £250,000 to women's football, and after gift aid is processed, the overall amount to women's football could be up to £312,500. So it's a large chunk of money. The initial phase of this funding will be distributed to clubs as well as to the Scottish Women's Football Association. So everybody will be seeing a little bit of this money, and it will go towards the costs of maintaining the club themselves, but also maybe giving them a chance to get the training operation up to schedule, and maybe giving them an opportunity to finally get their league calendar back up and running. Because I think UEFA have had the discussion about fixtures, and we will be mentioning that later, but in particular to the women's game, Glasgow City's Champions League quarter-final against Wolfsburg will be played, and it will be played in Spain on the 21st of August. And for a women's team to get in Scotland, I mean, any Scottish team to get to any quarter-final of, it doesn't matter if it's a woman or anything, tiddlywinks, I don't care. Yeah. A Scottish team has made the Champions League quarter-final, and it will be played on the 21st of August. That is massive. And I hope everybody gets a chance to watch this game.
For me, the women's football just went on strength to strength, because last year was the World Cup. Yeah, all the games were on the TV as well. And it was just a pity that Scotland was in it, but they get put out by Jubies. Was it VAR about 3 times or something?
Yeah.
And it could go in the Hampshire, Scotland.
Yeah, I suppose gender doesn't matter, does it? I mean, it's just Scottish football generally is a bit like that. Yeah. But even when you watch, I think Scottish football, we're in a position to challenge the big guns in women's football. So arguably, we're a lot better to watch in the women's game than we are the man's game, because we've not been to a male tournament since, 1998? But the women seem to be able to be doing it in international football. They can do it in the club football. I think maybe we should all turn our attention to the women's game and just leave the men's game to it for a bit.
Exactly. Going back to the men's game, just for a wee minute or two, obviously the season finished now, and well, Scotland get finished a few weeks ago, but still rumbling on about the Hearts situation, and speak about that in a minute. But I wanted to quickly speak about the player of the year and the manager of the year in Scotland, and I don't know what your views are on it.
I think, well, we'll start with the player of the year, I suppose. Now, Odson Edward won it. I don't think there can be any dispute really about that. He, I think, was the go-to player in Europe in the league. He was outstanding for Celtic all the way through, scoring goals. And I think he was Odson Edward was a worthy winner of the Player of the Year award by miles. I think for Celtic fans, the only thing of a positive that's come out of COVID is it may stop any clubs coming in for Odson Edward in the summer.
Mm.
So he may well stay for 10 in a row because of the COVID crisis. So that might be the only benefit for Celtic, really, of the whole COVID crisis affair. The other Player of the Year in contention for Celtic was Callum McGregor. Now, I think he is probably your top player in regards to performing on a consistent basis. Callum McGregor, I think, even on his worst game, he might get 7 out of 10. He's consistent, if not being spectacular sometimes. So I think he was worthy to be in it. Obviously, I don't think he was in the Edward category, but Callum McGregor was definitely a very consistent performer for Celtic on a match-to-match basis. The other player for Rangers who was nominated was Alfredo Morelos. Now, arguably, he was probably the best player in Scotland up until December. He was scoring goals for fun. Rangers were challenging Celtic neck and neck, really, for the title up to December. And Celtic had an amazing first half of the season. The fact that Rangers were challenging him just shows you the level that both of these sides were at that time, and that Alfredo Morelos was scoring goals for fun. What let him down, though, however, was when, like Rangers, when they came back and after the break, he only scored, what was it, one goal possibly after the break?
Yeah, because there was a big rumour, wasn't there, when they went to Dubai about was a fight between the players or did they not get on over in Dubai? So there was a bit of a rumour about that.
Yeah, and he, I don't want to belittle his character without really knowing the guy, but he would seem to be at the centre of most of this kind of stuff. And there was also rumours that I think he was looking for a move to England, possibly too, that never materialised in the January transfer window. So his form completely fell off, so there was no chance that he was going to win it as player of the year as such. But I think it's worth noting that up until December, he was playing very well. And lastly, Dundee United had Lawrence Shankland. He fire Dundee United really to win the league and the championship. So, and he will go on to do probably bigger and better things than Dundee United. I think Dundee United possibly are prepared to lose him, unfortunately, with this transfer window coming up. And they're looking at other players really to see who they can replace him with in case he goes. But Lawrence Shanklin was amazing in the championship last season and well-deserved nomination for Player of the Year. But I thought Odds and Edward was a fair winner, to be honest.
Nice to see Dundee United back in the league. They've got a good team, but they've got a nice stadium as well up in Dundee as well.
Oh, definitely. They're a massive club. And, you know, I know everybody's going on about Hearts being a massive club and they shouldn't get relegated because they're a big club. But Dundee United are an equally big club, equally big fan base. And arguably their team is better than Hearts at the moment. So I don't think Hearts will be a loss in the sense of being replaced with Dundee United. I think Dundee United will hold their own. It's just whether maybe they can hold on to players like Lawrence Shanklin because of his form. I think it'll be quite difficult for them to hold on to him. But again, like Edward, maybe the COVID crisis might be a little bit of a lucky charm in this instance, in the sense that maybe he won't go because of that, whereas I think he might definitely have gone if COVID hadn't happened.
Matthew, you teed that up very, very nicely when you were speaking about Hearts, because that's what we're going to speak about next. Well done, Matthew. What can you say? But also, the SFA, what can you say? Because to be honest with you, I think that's the making a big mess of this.
Hearts and Partick Thistle have started a legal challenge against the relegation. I mean, Hearts, Partick Thistle and Stranraer at the beginning of the week had their relegation confirmed by the clubs. Basically, the challenge was a 14-10-10-10 setup was what Hearts and other clubs wanted. The vote was had by the SPFL, and I think that's the only thing they've done positively in this regard, is that the clubs did democratically decide this. The Premier League clubs, only three voted in favour of the plan to have 14 teams in the Premier League and then 10-10-10. Championship, five clubs voted for it, but Division 1, four clubs voted for it, and in Division 2, four clubs voted for it. So overall, only 16 clubs indicated they would vote for a reconstruction, which sadly did mean Hearts, Partick and Stranraer were relegated. And it also meant, sadly again, Kelty Hearts and Barry Ferguson and the Highland League champions and Brora wouldn't be invited to the SPFL. Now, according to the SPFL, that was a line drawn under it. That was their view, is that that's a line drawn under it. We can start to focus on fixtures. The league will be starting on the 1st of August. That's the end of it. And it's been democratically decided. But Hearts and Partick Thistle have decided that that's not the end of it. They've told the SPFL this is just the start of the process. And they have started a legal challenge against their relegation. Now, Stranraer are involved in this. However, they can't afford legal action because I think legal action will cost a six-figure sum that Stranraer just can't, unfortunately, afford, which just shows you the legalities and what's right only goes so far in the sense of who has the money. Hearts were the first club to come out and say that they were going to do a legal challenge against it. Partick Thistle initially said they couldn't afford it, but a mystery benefactor has come in and said they'll pay for the legal fees. Now, no one joined the dots and say this is James Anderson and Hearts, but it has been thought that he might be the mystery benefactor, I don't know. But someone has come in and part of this will have said that they'll join the legal challenge, and that went yesterday to the Court of Session, and it's looking for either one, a reverse of relegation completely, or two, to get compensation for the loss of earnings that will be had due to relegation. And I think the cost possibly for compensation could be up to £10 million. Now, not only that, Hearts and Partick Thistle have ruled out at the moment that they could put a stop to the league calendar if it doesn't go their way, but they haven't ruled out going for that either. So that's still on the table, which if they manage to put a stop or a halt to the league season, that would cause absolute chaos.
Mm.
So that, unfortunately, is still a possibility.
But there's a few things here staring out at me here when we're talking about this issue. So if Hearts and Packet Thistle are going down the legal route, there might be a big hold-up with that, Matthew, because we don't yet know then when courts are going to be able to go back.
I mean, as far as I'm aware, I mean, I don't know the complete delays of the court system, but because the SPFL and the Premier League in particular have said that the season will start on the 1st of August, I think lawyers have given the SPFL 7 days to respond to this. I think normally, now I'm not a legal mind, but I think that the SPFL would have normally got longer to respond to this petition to the Court of Session. But because the 1st of August deadline is looming, they've only been given 7 days to respond to this. So I think they're trying to speed that process up to get a result one way or the other through. But the outcomes of this could be, like you were hinting on, could be ridiculous. I mean, the court system could be held up. Mm-hmm. Could hold up the league starting. Or also, if they win the battle in regards to reversing the relegation, does that mean there'll be 13 teams in the SPFL next year? I don't know. Do they then promote Dundee or whoever else just because they've got 13 teams? I don't know how that would work. But also, compensation could be a big one that the SPFL clubs would also have to fit. I mean, if they are looking at a £10 million bill, is that something that Scottish clubs could afford? And also, again, something that could delay it is Hearts and Partick could go down the route of delaying the start of the SPFL. And how would that impact on clubs as well? So the thing is basically one big mess. Yeah. The SPFL are saying that, you know, we'll draw a line under it. That is not going to happen. This is going to rumble on and on and on.
Am I right? Remember they said I'm right? Because to be honest, I wasn't listening to the whole debate because the whole debate was just getting to me and it was a bit boring after a wee while. But am I right in saying that Dundee actually started this about the whole kind of vote that they had weeks ago? Seemed like years ago now, but it was only weeks ago about they sent the email. But the SFA, they said, oh, we never got your email. And then they said, oh, we got your email. It was in my junk folder. And you're thinking, well, no wonder English football and other football around the world laughs at Scottish football if we can't get the basics right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a two-strained argument. And in one sense, I do think the SPFL, on one hand, did everything they could to get to the right decision. And I think that's probably what I'm clinging to at the moment, is that they managed to get to the right result. However, like you said, how they got to the right result was a complete mess. The Dundee thing, I mean, all these clubs have the power. I mean, the SPFL board are in charge of maybe finance, raising things like that. But in regards to who has the power as such, the clubs have definitely the power. Now, again, I don't know if there was a bit of power play involved with Dundee. Dundee originally voted against the season ending and then it got lost in the junk pile, and then they realised that the vote wasn't there. They also realised that Dundee had the balance of power because they were the only vote that hadn't come through yet, and if they voted yes, it would happen, the league would end, and if they voted no, the whole thing would collapse. Now, I don't know if Dundee voted no to appease their fans and not give Dundee United the championship title, and then realised that no, they actually wanted the money, and that their vote was the casting vote, and they actually needed the money, and the only way they would get the money is for the season to end. So they miraculously did a U-turn. I have no idea what happened in their mind, but eventually the right decision was made. It was just a complete mess. a complete mess.
I mean, even down to the fact that, okay, this is another conversation for another day on another show, but even that the fact that when a big incident happens in English football, right? Say, talking sake, it was the Arsenal-Man City game, and there was a big debate, and Kieran Tierney gets sent off, and so he would be automatically suspended for the next game. But up here in Scotland, if you get sent off, Matthew, in the game, you would be playing for 2 weeks before you actually get hauled up, before the kind of like big beaks in Scottish football, before you get suspended. So the whole setup of Scottish football is a bit dinosaur, and they need to sort out from top to bottom.
Yeah, this again, I suppose, comes back to the SPFL and the SFA procedures and rules, I think, do need to be looked at. I do also think that reconstruction needs to happen. I'm not against that. It's just whether you do something like that in the middle of a world pandemic, and you do it on the basis of a 2-week discussion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think those things that you mentioned and everything else to do with Scottish football, I think, needs to be looked at, definitely. I don't think Scottish football can go on like this. I also think maybe video technology can be used to help referees in Scotland. I'm all for that too. I just don't know if a 2-week discussion on the basis of maybe Hearts getting relegated was the thing to do it. And also, I get the feeling, even though the SPFL board did in the end try and push for this reconstruction, I'm not sure if they did that out of fear of Hearts going to court, which eventually they did, because originally the SPFL weren't really keen on it. And I think that was shown because Hearts were really the only club that were seen to be pushing for reconstruction on a large level. I think if the SPFL were keen on reconstruction, they should have pushed for the reconstruction itself, not left it to Hearts. However, because they left Hearts to do it, it turned into a little bit of a mess, I think. And they shouldn't have left it to a club to do it if they were keen to get it done. Mm. And Hearts, for all I know, from what I understand, Hearts didn't even really discuss their policy with other clubs and things like that. So it came to the vote, and a lot of the clubs didn't really know what Hearts' real view on it was. So I don't really think that the SPFL backed them the way they should. They really should have pushed that through themselves if they believed in it. But also, you know, the voting system was a bit of a mess as well with it, and the SPFL never really did anything to try and push through a change of vote, maybe a change of the voting system to push through reconstruction. So I think it was a bit of a mess. I don't think the SPFL were really keen on it, apart from the threat of Hearts. Yeah. And I do think it should be better thought through. I think if you're going to look at this, you look at it over maybe a year or two and have discussions as to what would work, not 2 weeks and bang, we'll just get it done.
I was going to say we're going to come back to this issue, but I think we've all come back to this issue because it's not going to go away anytime soon. So speaking about Hearts, I think this show's kind of linked this week, Matthew, because then you spoke about Hearts. So I'm going to speak about Hibs now, across the road. You were saying to me this week about the financial crisis. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I know a bit about Hibs. Hibs players have been asked to take pay cuts for the whole season due to the COVID-19. Hibs have had wage deferrals in place since the shutdown in March. The worry is obviously that weekly testing will put a strain on the club finances over the course of the season, especially with the lack of gate income coming in at Easter Road. So I think the players themselves have been asked to take the pay cuts for the whole season, not just up to recently. Also, signing players has been put on hold at Easter Road until this deferral scheme ends. So there'll be no more signings of players until this wage deferral finishes at Hibs. And also, players are leaving. So obviously, players of contracts have finished. For example, Whittaker's contract has finished along with other loan players. They won't be coming back, and no other players will be coming in to replace them in the meantime. I think Hibs have also suggested that their revenue over the course of this season will be halved. Now, that is very scary. Hibs obviously are a big club and a very well-run club, but they're talking about revenue being halved in places for this whole season. And non-playing staff are being offered voluntary redundancies at Easter Road. And some youth club coaches have been allowed to leave, such as Lee Makel, Grant Murray and Colin Nish. So even though Hibs are one of the better run clubs in Scotland, and arguably third or fourth best run club in the country, maybe them and Aberdeen are on par, this might be the tip of the iceberg in regards to football clubs, because if Hibs are struggling, what does that say about every other club in the Scottish pyramid?
See, I think that's the difference between the Premiership in England and Scottish football, because if you're saying Hibs are one of the top forces in Scottish football and they're a well-run club and a good supporting club as well, they always kick out away a good away support when they go away from home. They're in financial crisis. But I think obviously this can take up a full show, but obviously it goes back to the TV deal as well, because I mean look at English football, because I'm not seeing English football, like certainly the Premiership clubs anyway, and also League One, they're not in trouble because of the TV deal that they've got down there and stuff, you know. So you're just thinking, well, it's a bit of a shame because Hibs is one of our big clubs in Scotland, and you know, then financial trouble. So that's quite sad to see that. But hopefully they get sorted out. Maybe they want James Anderson to come in there as well.
I think it'd be helpful. But it's funny you mentioned the TV deals, because obviously it's well known, and I think we spoke about this last week, and that Scottish football and Scottish sport in general is more dependent on fans coming in the door than many other football countries in particular, because the TV deals aren't as large. And I think even, you know, there'll be no fans coming in the door, so that's the big money-making of the clubs gone. But also, we spoke about Sky Sports, and I think the compensation that Scottish football will have to pay to Sky Sports is about £1.5 million over the next 5 years because they missed games last season. And now BT Sport have even said that the compensation they're likely to receive for the matches missed last season will be £2.3 million. So TV companies not only are not giving Scottish football as much as other leagues, but they're also having to be paid back compensation for games missed last year. But going back to Hibs for 2 seconds, the fans are trying to rally around Hibs, and I'm sure this is happening at a lot of other clubs, but the Hibernian Supporters Limited are a sort of fans-run based association that were trying to originally buy or take over Hibs up to the Hibs takeover. They now are currently taking donations for fans to put into it. So if you're a Hibs fan, I suppose it's quite good to put a donation into the Hibs Supporters Limited, and they will pass it on to the clubs or to the club, because without fan revenue coming in, and like you said, with the TV deals being small and compensation obviously having to go back as well, clubs have no money or very little money coming in. People are having to be laid off, more importantly. But first team, obviously, if you're looking for your first team to be challenging next year for anything, there might not be enough players to be able to do it. So I think the fans are sadly going to be called for now than ever than to put money into the clubs. And Hibs are obviously, I think, what the tip of the iceberg with this.
It's a shame to see, because obviously if this didn't happen, like the coronavirus, Hibs wouldn't be in this situation.
No, and you know what? It's even more sad because Hibs have obviously just been taken over by an American owner. The AGM there, just before the COVID crisis, Hibs were talking about strengthening the first team, improving facilities at Easter Road, improving the youth setup. They were talking about getting big screens at Easter Road, like Celtic Park and Ibrox. Hibs were a very, very ambitious club and were looking to go places this summer, and the COVID crisis has just put that to a stop. In fact, it's put it into reverse.
What I would say about Hibs, I don't know Hibs that well as a football club. I know you know them a bit more than me, but I've only been a few times to games and working and stuff like that. But it is a nice stadium, and it is a good atmosphere there as well, you know.
I'm going to probably anger a few people, but it's the best football stadium in Edinburgh.
Yeah, apart from Murrayfield.
Yeah, apart from Murrayfield.
But we're doing well this week, Matthew, because I said Murrayfield there, so because we're going to speak about rugby now, and you were telling me some news about rugby this week.
I mean, Murrayfield's a funny topic, because before I say about rugby, Murrayfield has also been mentioned as one of the stadiums that they could use if football was to go back and have limited crowds numbers, I think Murrayfield was mentioned as one of the stadiums that could possibly do that. So, I mean, Hibs and Hearts maybe have an average crowd of about 20,000. They were talking about Murrayfield being one of the stadiums that they could use and fit 20,000 people into Murrayfield, which holds about 67,000. So Murrayfield could be used for that. But to go back to the main reason Murrayfield used, arguably rugby. Rugby chiefs this in the next couple of weeks will be talking about the scheduling for rugby into 2020 and 21 because of the COVID. So normally what happens in rugby in Scotland tends to go on a summer tour or a summer test every summer. And that has been scrapped due to COVID this year. So there'll be no summer tours. I think Scotland might have been due to go to South Africa. That's been cancelled. And club rugby, obviously club rugby in Scotland's been cancelled. But within club rugby up the scale, the Pro 14 and European Champions Cup rugby looks like it'll be moved to a December to July window to try and get the remaining Pro 14 fixtures completed and the European Champions Cup completed. But as we talked about last show, that's a bit more complicated because you're playing clubs in other countries. So the Pro 14, they might have to go to Ireland or Wales or South Africa to complete those fixtures. And the same with the European Champions Cup. So that will be a bit more complicated. And I think that's why it might be pushed to December to try and get that up and running. The Six Nations as well, there was games that were missed in the March window. Scotland-Wales was missed. Yeah, there was. I don't think Scotland was the worst hit country, but they missed the last game, which was Scotland-Wales. Now, it looks like those games are going to move into the November-autumn test. So Scotland will play Wales most likely in November time, December time. But that obviously is a shame because Scotland were due to play New Zealand at Murrayfield in the autumn test, which would have probably sold out and been a big money spinner for the SRU. So that is good on one hand, but very negative on the other that the SRU will miss out on a big payday. But there is positive news as well from Edinburgh Rugby. They are getting a brand new stadium in Murrayfield. I mean, I don't know if you know Edinburgh Rugby very well, but they've been looking for a new home for many a year. Murrayfield Stadium itself is too big to cater for the 1,000 or 2,000 fans that go to Edinburgh Rugby. They've tried club venues around the country, but that's not worked because they're too small to cater for the crowds at Edinburgh Rugby. So Edinburgh Rugby have decided to make a new stadium or build a new stadium in the Murrayfield grounds, but right next to the Murrayfield Stadium near the ice rink.
All right, okay.
Yeah, so that had started, but it had to stop because of COVID. But the works have begun again, so hopefully Edinburgh Rugby will have a nice new stadium soon and ready for the Pro 14 commencing in December.
So Matthew, forgive me if I think a bit ignorant here, but I don't know much about rugby, but I thought the Six Nations games were all completed before the coronavirus, but obviously you're saying that they missed out one or two games at the end.
Yeah, I mean, Scotland-Wales wasn't completed. Scotland-Wales was the last game for Scotland down at Cardiff. Now, the game wasn't called off until the very last minute. It might have been the Friday even, or the Saturday before the game was called off. Now, fans had made the journey down to the, I don't know what it's called now, I always call it the Millennium Stadium, but it's called probably something else now, but down to Cardiff anyway. So that game was called off at the last minute, but other games were also postponed. One of which was here in Ireland. Ireland were due to play Italy in the Six Nations just as the coronavirus hit Italy. Now, in his wisdom, the Irish government and the IRFU postponed that game here in Dublin because they didn't want Italian players and Italian fans coming over to Ireland and possibly spreading COVID-19 at the time. Mm-hmm. But in the wisdom of Leo Varadkar and the Irish government, not to get it political, but they cancelled the game, but they didn't cancel flights from Rome. So lots of Italians came over regardless. And maybe arguably speaking, the COVID crisis started in Ireland not long after that. So just speculation, but it's funny how it worked out that way. So yeah, they cancelled the game, but didn't cancel the flights, and the Italian fans came over anyway. We're all over Dublin that weekend, so they made one right decision and made the wrong decision on the other. So, but that game was cancelled. So there's a few games left to run in that Six Nations.
So I think we'll come back to speak about rugby in a few weeks, maybe a few months when the Six Nations are back up and running. So thanks for listening this week. to the second episode of The Locker Room on Indie Live Radio. Don't forget, if you've missed any of the show, how dare you, the show gets repeated on Indie Live Radio, and if you've missed a repeat, you can catch the podcast. It's available on the website. Just go to Indie Live Radio website and just look for the podcast and look for this show called The Locker Room. So we'll be back next week with some more news about, hopefully not about Hearts and Packet Thistle, but other
you know it well.
Bill. Yeah, I know. I've got the T-shirt, Matthew.
Do you know, we'll get to the point where we'll be just replaying these shows because yeah, it's just the same notes recycling itself.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so have a good week, and thanks, Matthew, and we'll speak to you next week on Indie Live Radio.
This is a new voice for a new Scotland.
Indie Live Radio.